Hello, everyone. Welcome to This Must Be the Place, the Building Science Podcast. I'm your host, Shauna Henderson. Each episode is a deep conversation with a carefully chosen peer about not just houses, but place. Yeah, of course we talk about houses and retrofits, but we also want to change the industry for the better, forever. Energy poverty, community engagement, industry disruption, societal responsibility, and climate change. It's all here and so much more. We're back. This Must Be the Place, your building science podcast. I'm your host, Shauna Henderson, and today I get to chat with Chris Magwood. He's a crusader for reversing climate change, and for the past 25 years, he's dedicated his career to inspiring and assisting others to do the same. He builds carbon-storing buildings that are healthy, beautiful, and efficient, and there's a whole bunch more that we'll get to on that topic. So welcome to the podcast, Chris.
Yeah, thanks. I'm glad to be here. I see every time you post about a new podcast, like, I got to listen to that one. It looks great. So,
I'm very excited about being able to do this and share so many amazing people's stories. Amazing people's amazing stories. That's the statement. Yes. Yeah. So we have crossed paths many times over the years. So I started out a billion years ago. I was doing some straw bale work. I did some research work with Don Fugler at CMHC on measuring moisture in walls. And then I had a couple of articles published in The Last Straw, which I took a little dive back into. So that's pretty cool. That was started in 1992 as a journal. But prior to that, it had been a listserv that had such illustrious names on it as Matt Smearman and Judy Knox, Mark Pipecorn, Rob Tom, John Swearingen, and John Straub. And Mark Pipecorn actually was the editor / publisher of Environmental Building News, which went on, and I think that transmuted into Green Builder Advisor. So that's sort of
setting up. You find people who got their start in straw bale all over the industry now doing all kinds of
things. Yeah. So I want to definitely talk about why that is. I know what my story is, but you've got two roles currently, and I wanted to set this up because it's super important, because straw bale, is kind of this groovy hippie thing, but there's real powerful lessons to come out of that, and they all revolve around low carbon construction, which is like your bailiwick. So how did you get into this world?
Well, the same as you, sort of via the straw bale building, and actually the some of the testing work that you did early on is what enabled me to get my building permit to build the first permitted straw bale house here in Ontario. That to me speaks volumes about why there are so many people who got their start in straw bale in really interesting places in the industry, is that we really had to know our stuff to be able to do what we wanted to do. And in particular around building science, right? People were worried about straw bale buildings rotting, and that meant that everybody doing straw bale had to understand moisture migration, vapor drive, drawing potential, like all of that stuff was key to, convincing people that it was okay, but also knowing what we were doing and that what we were doing was okay. And I feel like that knowledge was just, at the fringes of the mainstream building industry, but people in the straw bale and other sort of alternative building worlds really had to take that to heart and learn it well and know it inside out and apply it. And I think when that's baked into your practice kind of from day one, you look at buildings in a really different way,
And it's
measurements, as a must, fire tests, moisture tests, thermal tests, you know,
structural
what were
tests,
the results, why, structural tests, and why do those numbers matter? What should the numbers be? What's a good number? What's a bad number? Like, all of that is stuff that, you know, if I had just gone down the path as a sort of conventional builder, I would have just done what sort of I was told to do, or, you know, accepted the common wisdom of the whatever numbers existed for those materials, because I wouldn't need to look into them. But I think we really had to know it. Often we had to do the tests ourselves or commission them and be involved in them. And I think that was such an amazing way to start a career in building, is like, oh, like, I have to know everything.
And then there's just the giant leap of faith that you've actually done the work.
Yeah.
And I think one of the big things for me was I came into it after doing some training and becoming an R2000 evaluator. And the really super interesting thing to me at that point was when I started looking into straw bale, and I fell in love with Adobe building first, but of course that will not work in Nova Scotia for a billion reasons, including the fact that we don't actually have clay soil here. We have granitic, falling apart, crumbly soil. So that aside, the conventional building science, although it was very much on the money in terms of the issues, heat, moisture, and air flows, was really restricted to the materials that people knew. So the pushback on straw bale was, oh, it's not going to dry because we know that fiberglass doesn't dry. So, but in fact, what we found was that straw can accommodate a huge amount more moisture because it is just this material that will ebb and flow if it has some drying potential, whereas fiberglass would never do that. It gets wet. It just stays wet, and then everything rots and then your house is dead. But that was a really simplified version of it.
There we go. Building science in a nutshell.
Yeah. Okay. We're done. Okay. Thanks for coming up. No. But that was one of the things. So to your point that, you know, we had to measure, we had to prove beyond reasonable doubt that there was, that there were any issues, or that we could figure out the issues behind straw. So yeah, I moved out of it when I realized that it was going to be a very niche market. And because I was already working within the R2000 program, felt that I could better start taking that information from these super insulated, low carbon material builds and working in indoor air quality, because of course you want to make sure that there's no moisture, et cetera, to prove the point of straw rotting. So I took all of that and pushed it back into mainstream building, you know, for whatever kind of influence I could have on that. But that was neat, sort of stepping away from the natural building, should I call it a movement?
Yeah, I think certainly had that feel, you know, in the like earlier days.
Yeah. And then I also had this place where it was like, people were like coming to me and say, well, we want to build a straw bale house. Will you be, you know, will you help us? And I would say, sure, it will cost you this much money per hour for my time. And they go, you're going to charge for this? I'm like, yeah, it's natural, not free. But I mean, you've probably bumped into a lot of that too, that kind of pushback on it. Well, this is a groovy hippie thing and, you know, it should be full of love and granola. And
yeah. And, you know, I mean, very early on, you know, my partners, Pete and Tina, and I decided that we were going to make a living building straw bale houses. And so we had to sort of get past that and find the people who wanted to work with us. You know, not that we were charging a premium, but if you're going to pay somebody X dollars to build you a conventional house, you should be open to paying somebody the same X dollars to build you this other kind of house. That, and so, you know, I think we just had to get very realistic about that quite quickly. And, you know, it was interesting because we, there's the part of straw bale and all those other things where people like to get their friends and neighbors together and do a bale raising. And that's like, it's such great fun. And of course, mm-hmm. you want to do that.
And you get those bale frenzies happening.
Exactly. But we also
and the light and the yeah. walls.
Yeah. So we kind of saw that happen, you know, and, you know, we kind of had two approaches. One is, you know, we'll take responsibility and we'll do this to a professional quality developer, right. or we can do it this way where we'll do our best to bring that. But, you know, if you're supplying the workforce and that's who's doing the work and they're not professionals and, you know, it will mm-hmm. be what it will be. But yeah, it's, and then I, you know, I guess I sort of had this path that went from that, you know, that sort of like groovy straw baleness to.
And was that Endeavor Center? Is you and your partner?
No, it came later. So, you know, we had a private contracting company for about a decade. And, you know, as we started building, you know, for us, that sort of the worlds of natural building and high performance building, you know, that's where I kind of both wanted to be, but sort of really enjoyed being is, you know, the groovy part of straw bale aside, it's like, but how do you do this quickly and affordably and airtight
and efficiently
yeah. and all of that kind of stuff. And so, you know, that's what I spent my time doing was trying to, you know, figure out, you know, how do you take this kind of unique material and get it to the point where you can deliver it for a comparable cost and the finished product is, you know, of a sufficient quality and durability and all of that kind of stuff and level of performance that bit sort of isn't just as good as a conventional building. It's better
right.
than.
Better. Yeah. Right. Yeah. 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 I think working that world and coming up with, you know, these lovely thick, you know, 18 and 24 inch walls, contemplating R30 to R40 plus wall, you know, nominal R value in a wall. In that scenario, when I pushed back out into mainstream building, I was like, well, we can do it with straw. Why can't we do it with all of these other conventional materials that have all of this testing already done on it? It's just a matter of figuring out how the system works. It's not, it's nothing that is out of the ordinary. It's what we've always been doing. So yeah.
So it's I think that's the thing when people think about innovation in building, you know, there's always this tendency to be like, well, you know, people want all the best stuff and they want it sort of like quickly and at scale and all of these things. And it's like, well, no, like there's actually a progression and a learning curve. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you set out with certain intentions, like human beings are very good at figuring out problems, but we don't figure it out on the very first go and, you know,
right.
get better on the second go. And we're getting pretty good on the third go. And by the 10th or 12th or 20th go, we're really good at it, but you have to give it that much time to, you know, like we can put up frame houses so quickly, not because a frame house is inherently a fast way to build. It's because we have 100 years of practice.
Right. And all these carpenters who have muscle memory.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they're not even, they don't have to think yet.
Yeah. Products that are manufactured to work in that system, like everything, you know, you build towards these systems being efficient, but they're not efficient on day one. But, you know, anybody who thinks that we can't take just about any system and make it efficient, you know, that's just not the case. Like we could.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think about, I saw when I moved out to my rural property, there was an old, like lime kiln on the property. And I was thinking, you know, concrete today is considered incredibly efficient. You know, you get on the phone, you call up your batching plant and this truck arrives and it dumps this stuff, but it didn't start that way. It started with somebody like breaking limestone out of the ground and hauling it with a horse over to a kiln and cutting down wood and burning the wood underneath that to fire that limestone and then grinding it up and then getting the gravel. And like nobody would have looked at that and said, yes, like that's,
I am glad it's built back
the way to build a
house. Yeah. You want me to build a what? An ICF? What?
I feel like, and you can see that arc in the straw bale world where, particularly in Europe now, there are some amazing prefab systems. It's like,
right,
the whole house comes on a truck. It gets put up in a day. It's
so it's just flat pack.
Yeah.
IKEA style. And I love that.
And
I'm about
quick and it's affordable.
Yeah, and beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that we really, there's so much inertia in the industry that we, you know, it kind of boggles me every once in a while. So that's this whole section of the podcast this season is about innovation and disruption and, and who's out there doing the things in the field that are actually making big change. And one of the things that I wanted to point out in terms of your innovation and your thoughts about this little, natural building movement that sort of moves in batches or stops and starts is when Passive House first came into North America, R2000 was still actually flourishing in some places. And there was a lot of sort of, arms folded across chests and people saying, well, we have R2000, so we're just fine. And, Passive House is just going to be, it's just going to be a little fad. And then it got more traction. And then it was like, maybe, Passive House is going to be the innovative edge, but it's never going to be anything other than a niche market. And now we're seeing whole communities and whole regional building codes actually saying Passive House standard, we'll accept that.
Mm.
So just, you never know where these things are going to roll into. So just like you said, in Europe, where they now have manufactured straw bale prefabs, that may or may not work in North America ever just because of our geographic the capacity's there. But it's a really good indication of that we can work with all sorts of different materials and very effective and cost effective and energy efficient ways.
Yeah.
Plus low carbon. So now let's talk about low carbon. And you've got two roles now. Manager in the Carbon Free Buildings Program at Rocky Mountain Institute, RMI. Congratulations on that. That's exciting.
Yeah.
Cool. And in Europe, they were all the big dogs. And then second is you are director at Builders for Climate Change, an organization you helped to establish. So I really want to talk about all the things you're doing. And then I want to go back to how does Endeavor Center put you in that position, or build Endeavor Center into that mix as well, right? Because that's a really cool piece that you worked on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Endeavor was really, it is really cool in that, we were teaching people to build these kind of buildings that intersected natural building and kind of production / high performance building, showing people how you can do that. And so we got to make a lot of really great buildings. So many clients who were just willing to respect that we knew what we were doing. And, if they set up the goals that they wanted to achieve, being really great about letting us achieve them in often very innovative ways. So, we got to do so many firsts at Endeavor, from, the first prefab straw bale building in the country, first use of earthen plasters in a load bearing scenario, earthen floors, compressed earth bag foundations, on and on. We got to just work with so many really great materials, hempcrete and things like that, and kind of figure them out, and then sort of figure out how do they fit into this, how do you take them from these bespoke things that we're doing and then make them more widely applicable. So Endeavor was great for that. And so part of what really happened at Endeavor that was cool and it leads to the low carbon stuff is that, you know, I think because of that early straw bale training of numbers and the science and the metrics and all of that, I got really obsessed with metrics, right? Like,
as we all do.
Yeah. And I think that also for me partly came from starting my building career in the sort of mid-90s when sort of green everything became cool. And suddenly, you know, every product in the world was green in some way or another. Like there were green labels and green this, like everything was green. And so for me getting my start then, it was very clear that these things, a lot of these things aren't green. And so I had this very strong, like prove it kind of mentality from the start. And so the way you prove those things is to sort of know the numbers, know the data, and be able to kind of compare metrics. So at Endeavor, you know, for our clients, we kind of came up with this criteria matrix thing that was all about those metrics and our clients telling us what metrics they wanted to hit. So, you know, we had 10 different criteria from energy efficiency to indoor environment quality to, you know, like cost to all these different things. And then four categories, like, do you want to hit the best, you know, possible thing in that category? Do you not care about it at all? And so we were starting to put numbers to those things, like whether it was cost per square foot or, you know, energy use or whatever the metric happened to be, we were really interested in those metrics. And so the buildings that we did at Endeavor, it was great because we weren't able to just say, look, we did this cool green building. It's like, look, we did this building and it performs at this level there, you know, the indoor environment quality, the indoor air quality has been tested. We've, you know, we didn't accept any materials with like these chemicals in them. It cost this much went to landfill, this much waste went to recycling. Like we were measuring everything. And so I think that, you know, that was such a great, you know, training field for me, but also all of our students. And it's what led to the embodied carbon work, because as climate became, you know, like this is the thing we need to be paying attention to in the buildings world, I wanted to how to measure that, like what is the carbon footprint of these materials we're using. And so trying to figure out that, you know, 10 years ago was the start of all of this work in embodied carbon and carbon storing and low carbon buildings and stuff that I've been doing ever since.
Yeah, you've got a couple of great presentations I've seen in various venues, the last one being our very first and last face-to-face meeting in February of 2020 at the Net Zero Summit. So that was, and you probably over the last couple of years built on that, and you have another very cool tool that you've built. And I'm jumping the gun and feeding you all sorts of things to talk about, so.
Yeah.
Jump on in.
Yeah. Well, I would. Yeah, I'd love to talk about the tool.
Which we call
Beam. And it's, you know, it started as the tool that I started to build for myself and for Endeavor to figure out the carbon footprint of our buildings. And for I actually went back to school a bunch of years ago to do a master's program in embodied carbon, and I realized, well, if I'm going to try to make these model buildings and show what the carbon footprint might be with different materials, I kind of need a calculator tool to do that. So I kind of built up this spreadsheet and got these results and started presenting them. And then people were like, well, how'd you do that? Like, can I use that tool? And so at the time, no, nobody could use the tool because it was my own quirky little spreadsheet. But we got together a great little team at Builders for Climate Action and sort of turn that initial tool into a really great, really robust tool for specifically for kind of the low rise residential sector. And that's the reason.
And is that
I started building the tool myself is that when I went, my thought was I will use an existing tool to do this. But when I went to do that, the existing tools were very much meant for big buildings.
Right.
Office towers, condo, like large buildings using concrete and steel and very few of the materials that go into a low rise building. And also, you know, they didn't have the ability to sort of interchange lots of pieces in an assembly, and they certainly didn't have any of the alternative materials that I was interested in. So all of that.
So
I'm going to have to make my own tool to, you know, to be able to do that. And then it turns out, yeah, this market doesn't have a tool. And so.
Because the closest thing that I ever used was Athena.
Yeah.
And that was, felt like it was really, you know, just giving a general approximation maybe for residential. Which, and I mean, I think it works really well in other scenarios, but it was definitely a start. So, and is this tool online? And can it be, is there cost associated with it, or how do people find out about it?
There's no paywall, so people can download it from the buildersforclimateaction.org website. We do ask people to contribute because we're a small organization making this tool. We didn't want to put it behind a paywall because we didn't want to stop anybody from accessing it, but we sure appreciate it when people, you know, give it a bit of value and send us a few bucks to use it. But yeah, it's been out for about 3 months now. We've got 715 users and
sweet.
Yeah,
that's great.
Yeah, it's been like a very fast uptake. Lots of, you know, it really opens people's eyes very quickly. Like we get so much feedback from people going, oh my God, I had no idea that, you know, this or that was, had such a big carbon footprint, or this one had such a low one, or that there was such a difference between, you know, this or that. And, you know, we can see people already sort of, it happened in the energy efficiency world. As soon as you see the numbers and you have any drive at all, it's like, I want to do better. And the next time I want to do better again. And we can see people like already, you know, coming in way under the sort of average threshold that I found in my early research and, you know, quite a few people pushing, you know, to pretty close to zero carbon footprint buildings today.
Wow. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I think that, you know, going back to energy efficiency, we have, you know, generally people are familiar with HOT 2000 modeling, but that was always disconnected from the cost of doing it. So when Enercan introduced the cost benefit analysis tool that went with that relied on HOT 2000 modeling, I did some beta testing for that, and again was like, oh, look at these numbers! Oh, wow! You know, the things that we, you know, might consider to be standard issue construction, like if we just tweak it a little bit, there's money to be saved, and in the actual process, right? So either you can offer the same, you know, the same finished building at the same price and have a little bit more profit, because, you know, builders' profit lines are squeaky at the best of times. Or you could drop your price because you've got something that's far more, you can actually see that the changes that you can make in terms of energy consumption or energy savings and how they directly relate to putting the thing together. So they're smashed together, basically an estimating tool with the energy savings piece, which is excellent. And I'm looking forward to that. And then that, how can we plug that whole thing in with Beam?
Yeah, well, it is
and make that item. Cost value.
Yeah, but yeah, we did a version of Beam for Enercan. They call it the MC squared tool, but it's essentially the same data set, the same calculations, but built to, so you can import a HOT 2000 model right into it. And kind of next step is being able to incorporate it into that CBAT cost estimating. So that's kind of underway now.
That's fantastic to hear.
Yeah. And so hopefully I'll be able to get all three of those things together. Like what's the energy performance, what's the cost, and what's the carbon footprint, and how
carbon footprint. And then how do you mix and match those things and come up with what your client needs, how to meet your client needs, how to meet targeting requirements or either energy thresholds or carbon loads. Yeah. That's fantastic. I've been sort of out of it with my head down, working as much as possible while I've been recovering from COVID over the last several months. So I didn't know that. That's great. Congratulations. Yeah. So what are you doing with Rocky Mountain Institute, with RMI?
Well, the same kind of stuff around buildings and materials and carbon. So I'm in there embodied carbon team and working towards the same kind of focus, like trying to help the residential sector really figure this out in a way that we get really big emissions reductions at the speed that we need to have them, but doing it affordably and maintaining energy efficiency and improving indoor environment quality and trying to bring all of that. That's
just the holistic thing. That means that people are safe, healthy, and comfortable.
And there's a beautiful climate to live in.
Right. Yes. All of those things work together, either inside or outside the house, as far as I'm concerned.
That's right. And you know, there's it's a little bit frustrating because there's constantly this. Everybody has the sense that there always has to be the trade-off, right? Like, if you're going to do the low embodied carbon thing, you're going to have to give up on energy efficiency. Or if you do this, you're going to have to, or it's going to cost more. And it's like, no, you know, we can do all of these things. It's not that difficult to put them all together. Yeah. And you know, the same way,
but you know, it's
that passive house builders figured out, you know, the first passive house buildings cost more. We were doing it for the first time. Like the materials.
Right. And so did the first 30,000 houses.
Yeah.
Right? Like when R2000 was around, you know, was in its heyday, people were like, oh, wow, that's a lot more expensive. And then, you know, what ended up happening was that people got way better at doing it. And I worked with, you know, here in Nova Scotia, we had the highest per capita construction of R2000 houses for many years. And it actually, because we're in a small market, it transformed our market radically. We're the first jurisdiction in Canada to put energy conservation measures into code, even before the model energy codes were in place. Maybe they were in place, but they weren't actually adopted into the building code. But it was pretty amazing for people to go from, well, that's just sort of fancy and cool, to, well, that's just standard issue housing, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah. We sell ourselves short as humans when we think we can't do these things. It's like, give us the laundry list. Like, we can figure it out. I always think people figured out how to make nuclear power. You know, like, making an energy efficient building out of low carbon materials is way less of an achievement than, you know, splitting the atom and containing that and turning it into electricity. It's a pretty straightforward set of things. And, you know, it's not a stretch to think that you can get all houses to passive house level and all houses down to zero carbon footprint and get the chemicals out of them and keep them affordable. Mm-hmm. Like, of course we can do that. Like,
I think I was looking at something came across my social feed yesterday or the day before that was just a whole series of checklists of, you know, things that have been changed in different jurisdictions in Europe. Where North America, we generally go, oh, we couldn't possibly do that, you know, and it was specifically around car culture, you know, and all of a sudden it's like, well, here's whole cities that are built completely differently and new construction that's being built differently and planning that's being done differently. And, you know, you're hard pressed to even be able to purchase some of the things that we would contemplate as being regularly available things. You can't purchase those in, like, for Japan, and I'm moving around and jumping around because I can't actually remember the whole context, but it was about what struck me was you can make change in any situation, and the only way that you make change is shifting how you value something. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one of the things that we can shift is how we value existing infrastructure and existing communities. So instead of plowing them down and building tall, huge apartment buildings or more office space like you're doing here in Halifax, you know, maybe there's a way to actually do a more pattern languagey kind of density building that would be better suited to people and walkability and not cars and not interests that are transient in terms of who's investing money in places.
Yeah, and I would add to that list, easier to make zero carbon. There's a threshold in building, and that's why I'm excited about the sort of, I always use the term low rise, but I actually sort of would lump mid-rise into that, you know, from...
So like up to what, like 7 or 8 stories?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay.
But, you know, in the sort of embodied carbon world, because it does focus on these large concrete and steel buildings so much, because those are the architecture and engineering firms that think about embodied carbon. Those are the people that have on board, you know, LCA consultants. And I'm really glad they do. It doesn't sort of belittle them, but there's a lot of hand-wringing about what do we do? Like, we need all this concrete. We need all of this steel. And my response is, if you brought the buildings down lower, you wouldn't need all of that. And you would be, you know, encouraging this kind of density. And now you can start to use the sort of really low carbon, zero carbon, carbon storing materials. You can make those buildings more efficient, and they make those communities more livable and walkable. You know, there's so many things that go hand in hand with that, you know, are sort of assumptions around density, and that, you know, the 80 story tower is like the best thing in the world.
Right.
It's only the best thing in the world for the person who owns those square meters of property in a downtown city and is going to maximize the return on selling, you know, 80 stories worth of units to people and seven stories of units to people. But it's not an inherently better way to build. And it's not even inherently more dense. Like, the most dense cities in the world are the Parises, the Edinburghs, the Londons, like, where it's full of, you know, sort of mid-rise. Like, it's not single family houses spread out on lawns. It's row houses. It's, you know, that kind of
the 3-story cold water walkout.
Yeah, with shops on the bottom floor and people living above. Like, those are the cities that people love to visit. Those are the places where that scale of density works. And, you know, I think we kind of ignore those models because it doesn't, you know, it doesn't generate the profits on the building side that developers sort of need and want and expect. But from all kinds of other views, like you were saying, like, if we value these other things, then we can change that.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things that always strikes me, especially because I work here in Nova Scotia with some of the oldest housing stock in the country. Yeah. So I was working a couple of years ago with a client. We were looking at renovating a house that was built in 1920-ish. And it had super good bones to it. There was nothing wrong with the structure. Had, you know, 30 foot clear 4x8 beams, or I can't remember if it's 4x8 or 6x8 beams in it. It's like 30 foot clear piece of 4x8 or 6x8, I can't remember. That doesn't exist in the world in very many places anymore. So when one of the contractors came in and said, oh, it's too costly to renovate this, just, you know, pull it down and build something new. It's like, you need to see the inherent value in the embedded resources in this building. Can't just, like, because, you know, maybe that gets carefully dismantled and that, you know, that precious wood comes out of there. Highly likely that it just gets mashed up.
Yeah.
And then it doesn't exist anymore. So it's like that, even the fabric of existing buildings, we need to be able to put some more quantifiable value on that. So if you have giant pieces of wood in your building that you can't find anywhere, then that has a distinct value, right?
Yeah.
It's a very rare piece of something that you can't get now. So either we build out a whole new impressive dismantling industry, and there are people who are doing that, or in situ, it has this value, and so that house actually has some inherent things that we can't pull away from it.
Yeah.
It's like giving, you know, giving rights to a tree or to a river.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I kind of ran off on a rant there, sorry.
It's parallel to a rant that I go on quite a bit, which And it always strikes me, because you were talking about some of the differences between sort of building in Europe and here. And the thing that always surprises me here is you have this very strong sort of like capitalist notion in North America that, like, you know, business knows what to do, the power market, all that kind of stuff is all kind of there. But we actually, I think, don't value that, because we always default to like, oh, you know, people won't figure that out, or, you know, it'll like cause too big a shift. But it's like every time you make new rules, capitalists figure out how to make money within those sets of rules. Like, if you made the rule that all buildings have to be zero carbon, I mean, and if you do it well, so not tomorrow, but, you know, give it a few years, people will figure out how to make money making zero carbon buildings. If you say you have to keep all your existing infrastructure, people will figure out how to make a viable business out of that. If you say you want to make all your materials out of biomass, we will figure out how to do that. I mean,
because we always do.
Yeah. Like, there's no one set of rules that are like, this is the best set of rules for business. I mean, pulling oil out of the ground is a crazy thing to do. Like, there's nothing inherently money-making about that. It's actually inherently a really hard, really expensive thing to do. But we set up some rules that made it profitable to do that. And lo and behold, we could pump oil out of the North Sea. And what do we want? And people will figure out how to do it and make money doing it. And I think we just need to sort of see that really clearly and trust that that's what will happen, you know, and put our values there. Do we need to hit, you know, zero emissions everywhere? We can do that if the rules say we got to be zero emissions. You know, everybody will figure out how to do it. You can watch the car industry starting to pivot right now. It's like, and they could have done that pivot 30 years ago, 50 years ago, if the rules were,
well,
there won't be any more internal combustion by 2035. Yeah. They will figure it out, and they'll still be profitable, and people will have cars. And we could have done that at any point. And I think, you know, we always forget that we can just make the rules that we need collectively, and the people who make money will figure out how to do that.
Yeah. I mean, we've definitely seen that over the years in terms of home building. The only thing that changes the industry and shifts it forward is change in the building code. It's the stick. If you're building legally, you're okay. But if you're just building to code, congratulations, you're just legal. It's like, is that a feather in your cap? Probably not, unless you're moving up into level, you know, step 4 or 5 of the building code in BC. We've always needed that stick. It's just, if there's no changes to the rules, it's business as usual. And that becomes more and more entrenched. And then we have this bottleneck and problem we have now, where we have an industry that's pretty, there's pockets of innovation, but it's still pretty stagnant in terms of how it's actually innovating. Well, are we taking the load off the human body as a pack horse and tool? Not really.
Yeah.
But not unless we're, you know, but when we look at prefabs and flat pack and that factory build, yes, but people tend to push away from that because there's almost a romantic aura of having somebody banging on sticks with a hammer to build your house. You know, like as if that ensures high quality because you can see them doing it. But, you know, at the same time, maybe they don't actually know what they're doing so much as they understand how to work within the parameters that are set. And yet, if we worked in factories and have either panelization or flat packs or prefabs that come out of the factory, they have to have QA. Right? QA, QC, quality assurance, quality control. Those things have to be in place. And you have less slowdowns because of weather. You have less site destruction or materials leaving the site with nobody's permission. That's a very fancy way of saying theft, I guess. What I meant. But there's a lot of real incredible positives about penalization and free fab, et cetera, that people don't really seem to get yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's strange too, because it's not even, it doesn't have to be that high tech. Like one of my favorite projects, maybe my favorite project that we did at Endeavor, was we built a completely sort of panelized house. And one of the things that we wanted to do, well, we had a bunch of things that we set out to do. One was to do it so that it was net carbon storing. One was to make it net zero energy. Another was to basically have no waste. But the big one was to make it prefab, but so that not only could you put it together quickly, but that you could take it apart and reuse everything.
Nice.
So the structure, but also all the finishes. And so we set up a tent, on a not-for-profit's yard here in town. We built the panels in the tent. We assembled the house on the yard. We put it all up. We took it all down. We took it to a design show in Toronto. We put it all up, and then we took it all down and we put it all up on a client's site. And it's like, and we did that as a not-for-profit school with a zero R&D budget, with no investment in anything, and using student labor. And it's like, it's not that hard to do. Like, making a box doesn't require a super high-tech factory. You could probably do it better and faster with, you know, some high-tech equipment. But yeah, just having a shelter that's out of the weather, and places to put your materials, and a base so that you're working on something, you know, flat and square, like those things are really easy. And, you know, we made this awesome little building at, you know, comparable costs to what any other contractor could have made it for. And you can take it down at the end of its life. Like, it's, you know, every single piece of it is reusable. And like, so why isn't that the rule? You know, the rule is, not only do you have to show us in your building permit how this goes together, but you have to show us how it all comes apart.
I like it.
Yeah. And, you know, it's great. Inside that building, if you ever want to redo the wiring, all the finishes inside are panelized with surface-mounted screws. Do I need to get to that electrical box? I take off that panel. I play around with the wires. I put that panel back on. Like,
nice. You know. Yeah.
Something gets damaged, I don't have to replace everything. I have to replace the piece that gets damaged. Like, there are so many, you know, it's so easy to do, and it's so, like, the repercussions are so major that.
Yeah. Ask anybody who's ever done anything in terms of renovating a UFO at all. It's like, this is like the horror movie of my life.
Yeah. Yeah. I sort of use the analogy, if we built our cars the way we build our houses, every time you change your oil, you'd have to smash the hood off your car and go apply a new hood, because we build our houses. You can't open anything. Like, everything is, you have to wreck the things to get to it. It's like, if you did that with your car, people would be like, what do you mean? I can't get to the engine. It's like, well, that's how we build our houses. You can't get to the engine without wrecking it.
Oh my gosh, I just had revelations. In fact, houses are basically they're like Apple or any company that don't allow you to fix it yourself.
Yeah.
Oh, there's a whole other line of thought I hadn't actually, like, okay, there's a rabbit hole for me to go down.
Yeah.
So we need to change the industry. We need to change how we get to places. So talk a little bit about what helps us move the needle to meet our embodied carbon benchmarks as we trip off into 2030.
Yeah. Well, having benchmarks is a good place to start. So that's one of the things that I've done over the last couple of years is we did a big benchmark study for Enercan. We did one for City of Toronto, Nelson. We're just finishing one for Vancouver. And so, you know, we've looked at about, I guess, 800 on, you know, single family and duplex and row house, you know, buildings in Canada, and feels like, okay, we pretty much know what the benchmark is now. It was really interesting. Between Toronto and Vancouver, the average carbon footprint of a home in those two places was identical, you know, despite the fact that there's differences in climate and differences in energy code and, you know, what the exteriors look like and all that kind of stuff. It was literally bang on. Like, you know,
wow.
Toronto was 191 kilograms per square meter and Vancouver was 193. Like, you couldn't be closer in terms of averages. And then, you know, we've done some studies for some developers here in Ontario, and their houses typically come in at that 190 mark. So it's like, okay, like, at least we know what the benchmark is now. And, you know, interestingly, that there are also builders whose houses are coming in at 20, 30, even 40% less than that in their business as usual form. So, you know, if the government is scratching its head going, how do we get, you know, the emissions down 40% by 2030? Well, if you look in the Toronto market, the average house is, you know, at that sort of 190 kilograms per square meter, and somebody else's business as usual is 150. That's the 40%. Like, if everybody build the way that person is building, and they're not doing anything special, they did not set out to build a low carbon house. They just, by the sort of happy mistakes of the materials they were choosing and the way they're going about doing it, their houses are that low. So it was like, there's so much low hanging fruit in that rise world that we can meet those 2030 targets of 40% reductions, no problem. Like,
doesn't just need to get the word out there.
Doesn't, like, it's with available materials. It's, you know,
yeah,
there, we can point to the houses. Like, there's that development where everything was 115 instead of 190 kilograms per square meter.
Is this information available publicly? Can you give me some links?
And I go over the show notes. Yeah. All those studies are on our Builders for Climate Action website. So, yeah.
Oh, cool. Okay. Well, we'll just point people to the Builders for Climate Action. Cool. Yeah. Okay. I want to, we're coming up to the top of the hour, but I didn't realize that you have written 7 books on sustainable building. So my little notes from my producer here. And you have a new book out called Building Beyond Zero, New Ideas for Carbon Smart Architecture. And so will you give me the link to that as well so people can
purchase it? Yeah.
Keep you afloat for a few more years?
tens of dollars that roll in from, you know, book royalties.
Great. Tens of dollars, yes. Yes, so there's a couple of books that I have yet to see any royalties off, but we won't go there. So I have 2 quick questions for you, and then we have to wrap it up. And I've been asking everybody about them. What's your all-time favorite nerdy, delightful thing about building science? What do you love about what we do?
What I love is how I feel like the thing that I was already doing, this sort of crazy straw bale building stuff, which I was doing for all kinds of reasons that had nothing to do with building science, turns out to be the kind of like the ideal building science assembly too. You know, like, it just is. I remember when buildingscience.com put out their like revised perfect wall, and it was like a flow through vapor flow through assembly. And they didn't say like straw bale with plaster, but honestly, like, that it is true. Like,
that's the model.
Yeah, it's the ideal. It's like got a you know, I'm gonna point to it because this is my straw bale wall right here. Like, it's got a visible air barrier. Like, this surface is my air barrier. If it's cracked, if there's a problem with it, I can see it and I can fix it. It's vapor permeable, but it throttles vapor. Like, it's not just, you know, moving quickly. The insulation and the wall surface has all kinds of, you know, moisture storage capacity. There's no thermal bridges. There's no convection going on in there. Like, you know, and in a fire, it's amazing because the insulation packs so densely that it doesn't combust, and there's a non-combustible surface on. Like, it's like, oh, all all the building science stuff, that it's all packed into this really basic. The bale came out of the field. The plaster came out of the dirt. And, you know,
and there you are.
It's kind of that symbol is also the answer to all of these building science questions,
really,
at least when it comes to low rise wall assembly stuff.
Yeah, cool. I love that. And second question, what building science BS drives you crazy?
I get driven crazy a little bit by the sort of like pursuit of either like the nth degree of accuracy or like the sort of nth degree of performance when it comes with these like blinders where it's like, that's all I care about, you know, and if you say to somebody, yeah, but the thing you're doing, it's got a lot of toxic chemicals in it, but it's like, yeah, but it's like 0.2, you know, whatever, so whatever better than the other thing.
I bet, like, right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, but what is poisonous? And, you know, maybe that matters too. So yeah, that sort of like all out, you know, performance, you know, when people, somebody's like got a 0.3 error change, but somebody's got a 0.28, then it's like, you know, we're probably fine at 0.6 like that.
Yeah, right.
So
yeah, The laws of diminishing returns and the people thinking in sort of like performance in a very narrow.
Yeah.
Concept as a very narrow concept.
Yeah.
Well, those are good ones. Excellent. Thank you so much for your time today, Chris. I really appreciate it. And I hope people will enjoy this and find out more about Builders for Climate Change and your new book and all that stuff. And that's it for today. Thanks so much for tuning in, everyone. See you next time.
Thank you for tuning in. This episode was produced by Blue House Energy, Podcast Atlantic, and Tanya Media. Subscribe and don't miss an episode. Leave a comment. We'd love to hear from you. Until next time.